Hi, everybody. Welcome to Paul Lisnick Behind the Curtain. It's my opportunity to step away from the worlds of politics and law you watch me cover on television every day into the world of the arts and fun and theater and all sorts of good stuff. I think today I'm going to put under the category of art, because that's the way it struck me. There's so many cool things going on in so many stories. You can make the decision for yourself as you meet my guest, Aaron Mankey. First of all, the king of podcasts, a well-known podcast producer, though apparently not of this one, and but of a famous one called Love and other things that come after it, has a new book out, which I think is also a program. I've got to find out about that. Let's find out.
Yeah.
We're going to talk about his new book called Cabinet of Curiosities, an historical tour. It says ahistorical, but it's like an historical tour of the unbelievable, the unsettling, and the bizarre. And it is just that. Hey, Aaron, thanks for joining me. This was fantastically fun to read, and I'm guessing you had as much fun putting it together.
Paul, thank you for having me here. And I did. It was a blast to create this show and gather these stories. We've been making the show for almost 6.5 years now. So there's about 200 in the book. But over time, we've put together about 1,400 stories on the podcast. So this is just a little sliver of what we have available.
And is the podcast called Cabinet of Curiosities? Because I want to listen to it myself.
Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. So my very first show came out 10 years ago called Lore, L-O-R-E. It's about the intersection of history and folklore.
Oh,
fascinating
I think I said
show.
Love. It's Lore. Sorry.
It's okay. Yeah. It's Lore. That was adapted for TV by Amazon for a couple of seasons. It's been published as a book series as well. The Cabinet was my second show to come out. And we've taken a lot of the early stories from the show and put them into this book and categorized them. They're gathered into categories like you would do in a museum. So it's nice and easy to read.
Yeah. And your next podcast series might be called Love, so that I'm not wrong.
It's okay. Don't worry about it.
Anyway, I loved it. And it was the title got me, but you were on our morning show, which if I'm not on it, I'm watching. And and it was just so fascinating. This is such great stuff. First of all, so going from lore, I mean, I guess there is a through line to all of this, but can you we have a little time. So if you can talk to my viewers and listeners, there's both, about what got you. And I think this stuff is fascinating, but I'm kind of a nerd. What brought you? Are you a fellow nerd?
I am. I mean, you know, I've got a Millennium Falcon behind me. I love history. This is the love that goes back to my childhood. I'm of a generation that grew up with those Scholastic Readers Club catalogs going home.
Me too.
You know, the color newsprints. Yeah, they were great for discovering
and
things.
And the books were like 35 cents and 50 cents. And
it was inexpensive. I mean, my parents didn't have a lot of money, but they were still able to get me things. And it was a book from probably fifth grade, in the autumn of fifth grade, that was about true but unusual history. And, you know, whether they were actually true or not is maybe debatable, but they were really fascinating stories. And then at some point in high school, I bumped into some paperbacks of Paul Harvey's The Rest of the Story, which I'm sure you remember. Paul Harvey, famous, you know, radio personality, wonderful voice, probably had to create stuff that fit a radio clock, you know, 3.5, 4 minutes long. But it was these stories that kind of hid a few details back from the reader or the listener, you know, just kind of prevented them from knowing instantly who he was talking about. And then at the very end, he would sort of, as the kids say these days, drop the mic and reveal the full identity of the person. And I think there was something about that storytelling style that just embedded itself in my DNA at that point. So when it came time to create a new show after such success with Lore being a half an hour show that really goes deep into one topic, I wanted something that had a bit more of that Paul Harvey delightful, let's just dip our toe in the pool kind of feel. And what better place than a cabinet of curiosities, right? To explore all these different wonderful stories. So that's what we've been doing for 6.5 years now.
It's fantastic. And by the way, we know Paul Harvey here well. If you come to the Museum of Broadcast Communication in Chicago, there is the Paul Harvey studio and wing, which is not far from the Paul Lisnick Gallery, by the way. Let me just toss that in there. But, so, yeah,
there
so
you go. I love that.
I'm a lover of history and weird things, and I have Abraham Lincoln's hair and just, yeah, all sorts of things. So I'm totally, I think, within your mindset of this. But here's the thing. As I read through this, and by the way, now that I did not get the Paul Harvey connection before, and now I totally do because the end
it's,
of
Medicare, yeah.
Yeah, and the stories, you know, most of them just are a page, you know, page and a half.
Mm-hmm.
But what's great is it's the kicker comes like the last line where you're reading all this stuff. And then all of a sudden it's, and here's who or what we're talking about. And you go, oh, I never knew that. That's what's fantastic.
Yeah, it's very fun. It does It does present a challenge in the writing process. How do I approach this story? How do, you know, I have a team of writers, and how do we approach this story in a way that doesn't, it doesn't give the cookies away before dinner, you know, that it actually lets them do a little bit of work. And I like the challenge.
Yeah, it's fantastic. And by the way, I will say that maybe just because of a similar love in me, there were some that I'm reading and going, I know what this is. You know, or I, and
Yes.
it's fine. In the end, I was happy to see that I knew who it was. But then there were some that surprised me. Here's the thing. It's not just about the bizarre in this book, and there's a lot of bizarre, but there's a lot of, and I think what makes this really fascinating, I'm going to use the word coincidence. There's
Yes.
coincidences that explain a lot of what happened here, or chance, the fate, the chance of fate. It's that's what makes you just shake your head and go, wow, if somebody had just, you'll know what I'm talking about, flipped a coin differently, things would have taken another turn.
Yeah, absolutely. It's one of my, it's probably my favorite category in the book, to be honest with you. If we did future volumes of this book, I think I always want there to be a coincidences category in the book. It's just, like you said, there's something magical about it. It shouldn't happen. And
Yeah.
yet these stories have happened, and I love that.
Well, let's talk about some of the things in the book, because obviously people listening to us, we're intriguing them, but they're, if I'm them watching or listening to us, I'm going, what? So tell me the kind of things you have. So I tempted you with my phrase of the coin flip. And of course, in that particular example, I'm talking about somebody named Jane, who could have gone one place or another, and she could have gone by train or she could have gone by plane. They flipped a coin, she went by plane. That was one of those that when I got to the end of the story, I knew exactly who it was, but I will admit, I didn't see it coming at first. I think on this show, you know, I don't like to give things away. I do a lot of theater here, and I always say to the actors ahead of time, I don't want to give up the surprises. I think here we need to, because otherwise, if we don't tell people who I'm talking about right now, it sits out there. So you tell the story, but let people know. I think you know what I'm talking about. Let's talk about where this one ends up and who the famous
Well,
person was.
I think this is why Hollywood lends itself well to this kind of storytelling, because there's a lot of people in Hollywood who their birth name is not the name we know them by. And that allows us to sort of hide the person while at the same time introducing the person to the reader or the listener. So, you know, for this story, the person that they get to meet is Jane Peters, who, if I say Jane Peters, most people will say, I have no idea who that is.
I didn't either.
Who had planned to board a train on the morning of, I think, January 15th of 1941, in Indianapolis. And there was, without reading the entire story and using 3 or 4 minutes here, I just remember there being some confusion about there was a flight that could happen. And Jane Peters' husband was a guy named Clark, and they had to make a call as to who got the seat on the airplane, if I remember correctly, and flipped a coin. Clark, by the way, was Clark Gable, probably a common, not a common Hollywood name. So when you hear Clark, you do think Clark Gable. Jane Peters I'm sorry. Yeah, Jane Peters was Kara Lombard. And so there's this idea that, you know, everybody knows both of their names, but you know, one of them died tragically young, and the flip of the coin was at the center of that. And you know, who's to say how it could have turned out differently, and what Hollywood history would be like without that.
And of course, obviously, Clark Gable and Carol Lombard were married. So this was a huge deal back
Yeah.
in that day, because Clark Gable was one of the biggest. So we have lots of Hollywood stories like that. There's another one, as long as that now my mind is there, because I've just got notes on so many of these things. But now my mind has gone with, you talk about the fact that cats have nine lives, but maybe there was a particular person, we'll call him Ernie, who also had nine lives, didn't know this story. I mean, I know how this person's life ended. But yeah, this was one where, again, we know a lot about Ernest Hemingway, who wrote For Whom the Bell Tolls, and his sad death at the end of his life. But I didn't know that a lot more went on in his life before he ever got there.
Yeah. I mean, you think that he's writing adventure stories as sort of the safe author in a room creating stories for his listeners to enjoy, when he was out there, you know, really living adventure stories. He and his wife had gone to, I want to say Africa,
Yes.
to
I think it was
Uganda,
Nairobi. I think it was
to,
Nairobi.
yeah, Uganda to Murchison Falls. And it was just a part of the Victoria Nile. And their plane crashed while they were there. And there's, you know, part of the story involves Ernie crawling out of the wreckage with a sprained shoulder. Mary had a number of crack ribs, his wife Mary. The pilot was unhurt, and he helped a couple set up camp for the night on the shores of the Nile, which, I mean, just sounds like a scene right out of a Hollywood blockbuster. And in the morning, one of these tourist boats going up and down the Nile came by and found them, and they jumped on board, and they took it back, and then they got it on another plane, which I have to say is probably pretty brave of them to get on the plane after that sort of
Oh, yeah.
experience. And this one took them out of Uganda, and when that plane took off, it almost immediately caught fire, and the flames took over the aircraft, and so they had to make for a kind of a safe, controlled landing. And this time, a different pilot ran into the cabin to open an emergency escape window. And he climbed through the window, and then he pulled Mary out to safety. But Ernie was left inside, and he was too big to fit through the window. And so this is just sort of the adventure that you don't expect a well-known author at his typewriter to have gone through. But yeah, Ernest Hemingway had quite the ride in Africa.
Yeah, and they kept going. There were just things kept happening to them. You spell it all out. But again, it's not like you say, let me tell you about Ernest Hemingway. You don't, until
No.
the end, you go, you might not know him as Ernie, but
That's
you know
right.
him as, that's what I love about this book. By the way, one cool way to do that would be, because sometimes I've like cheated. I sort of looked to that and I thought, you could have stopped me if you like that took those last lines and made it an appendix of the book. So I had to go find it afterwards to keep cheaters like me from doing what we do. And I know some of these stories are more famous. So I don't never mean to take you off guard with what you don't know. I'm going to, in a moment, ask you about animals because I'm all about animals and there's some dogs that show up in this. But before I get
Yeah.
there, I want to talk about one that I know you have at the tip of your head because you're always asked about this. But when I gave exams to students in my teaching days, I would often talk about one of the United States called Franklin. And the students always thought, well, there's no state of Franklin. You're making that up. And of course, I would say, no, it's true. And then, of course, and this is one of those that I read in your book. I'm like, oh, this one I know. But
Yeah.
there was indeed a state called Franklin.
Yeah, well, you because you've taught this story, you know the joy of sharing a detail of our own history. This is America. We don't have a deep and long history. It's just a couple of centuries. And to be able to share a story that few people know, there's sort of a thrill that comes with that. And so I love sharing this story with people. In the early days of the settling of the East Coast of North America, people were just sort of going where they wanted to and exploring and expanding. And so there was a number of settlers who had headed west from North Carolina and Virginia. And in the late part of the 18th century, the British had a rule or a law that said, let's not cross over the mountains because that's Native American territory. We can't protect you. We can't guarantee that you're going to live out there. And these people did it anyway. And, they fended off British attacks for a while. And they said, no, we're going to have our own community out here. And sometime in the 1780s, I want to say like 1784 or so, they actually tried to organize themselves as a new state. And so they petitioned the US government. Thomas Jefferson was in favor of this. I mean, he threw his weight behind it and he said, this is going to be a great thing. And they wanted to name their state after a true American hero, Benjamin Franklin. So they called their state Franklin. And they gave it a real good try for a few years. They elected a governor named John Sevier, and they really tried to just be ready for the government to put their stamp of approval on it. And the government said no. They said no. And so I think it was mid-1780s that the government said, no, we're not going to do this. And yet, about a dozen years later, they finally decided to start a new state in that same spot. They called it Tennessee. Their first governor, John Sevier. So Franklin is a town in Tennessee, and I'd like to think that that's a little remnant or a callback to what the state could have been, I suppose.
I actually would have kept it Franklin personally. I mean,
I think, yeah,
we don't
I
have
agree.
enough, but we do not have enough honoring Benjamin Franklin in this world.
No. He gets referenced a lot, but there's not a lot named for him.
Yeah, I mean, they gave him a mini series, but that was Michael, what's his name, playing it. Anyway, well, let me stay with the history theme for just a moment. There are several histories. I love history. I collect history. So I'm just so into some of this stuff. But here's one I didn't know. And it's the story of a clown whose name was Dan Rice. with me on that. So he was a clown, and in fact, what he did was called the greatest show on earth. Except when he was called the greatest show on earth, people think, well, that must be P.T. Barnum. Actually, he was around doing his clown thing, Dan Rice was, before P.T. Barnum ever even existed. But that's not why we know Dan Rice today. We know him by another name. In fact, could be a relative of ours. And so I knew I'd get you with me. And so I'll turn it over to you to explain to folks, historically, it's a historic story. Who is Dan Rice and what do we know him as today?
Well, I mean, he was a clown. He
Yeah.
also dabbled in politics. If I remember correctly, in
Yes,
the
he ran for president.
1860s, he ran for president. 1864, he ran for the Pennsylvania Senate, and he was, very popular as a performer, and he used that to get him to try to get into power. Later, when he appeared, he wouldn't secure enough votes to gain traction. He just sort of dropped out of the race. But people remember Dan Rice because of his physical appearance. If I describe him to you, you know who he is, but I think most people will. Think of him dressed in a red, white, and blue suit, with a top hat and that pointed beard, because Dan Rice, as a performer, went on to become the physical embodiment of the character that we refer to as Uncle Sam, and is forever immortalized as that character now.
And by the way, this I'm kind of going off the page for a little bit, but one could argue there's something bad going on here if we took a clown and turned him into Uncle Sam, kind of the our military whatever. But I'm sort of curiosity, do you think it was because of his foray into politics and running for president? Is that would he become Uncle Sam without that?
I think about this too. I think that clowns were really good mascots for troops of performers. And in a lot of ways, Dan Rice became a mascot for, the American culture. Again, this is 1860s, 1870s. And so, the country's about a century old and still creating some of the mythos that we have today. And I think they've just found a politically slanted clown who fit the mold, and it was just a moment of magic for him.
And it just worked and it stayed to this day, more or less. So I said I wanted to talk about animals because I'm all about animals. I mean, it just go to any of the shelters here and I've named everything around there. I like animals more than I do most people. There's a few dog stories, but one of them, and this I may be confusing two dog stories, but there was another one where the dog eventually bit somebody and they put him down. I hate that part of the story, but in the end, when they were told to just go bury the dog, they ended up stuffing him, and he's now in this would be the same dog, and he's now in the Smithsonian U.S. Mail Museum, and so
Well,
he's
and
still around.
it's a story that reminds me of another dog that's in the book whose name is Sergeant Stubby, and you
Yes.
wonder how did he get a military title. He was a dog that lived with its owner, with its human in Connecticut in the I think it was about Well, it was World War One. It was right as World War One was beginning. His owner was a student from Yale, and that student headed overseas to fight in World War One. And Stubby stowed away on the ship, and being there with his human, ended up providing the entire unit with, moral support. And they had a dog around, and he was fun. He learned to do tasks for them, and then ended up participating in four major battles. Four major offensives and at least 17 individual battles over the course of the dog's time there in Europe, mostly in France, and was awarded and decorated as a hero because of that service to his country. So Sergeant Stubby became like this animal hero for a whole generation of World War I soldiers, and he too has been stuffed and put in a museum. He happens to be in the American History Museum in the Smithsonian in Washington, D.C.
So I guess we walk to the Smithsonian. We're going to find lots of stuffed dogs
Lots of
around there
stuffed dogs, yeah,
who were
who
very
did amazing
heroic.
things.
Well, I'm going to give you a break from the stories. I'm going to step away from those for just a moment. I'm not done with those, but let me take a moment to go back because in putting a book like this together, my guess is it's not as though you're going, I can't find any stories. So it's probably the opposite problem. How do you determine which of these stories will make it in the book and which ones will either find a future volume one day, or you looked and said, not curious enough?
Well, I mean, finding stories for the podcast in general is a little bit witchcraft. I basically have to trust my intuition and say that one sounds like a Cabinet of Curiosity story, or that one doesn't. And I
Can I
like them
stop
to
you there?
have,
Let me just stop you there. What makes it sound like a Cabinets of Curiosity story? What is your a filter that you're using?
I like there to be some element that I can hide, something that we can hit the listener. At that point, it's a podcast, so it's a listener. If I can get the listener at the end with a little bit of a curveball, I think it just adds a bit of delight, you know? Also, over the years, what I've discovered is that there are a lot of grade school teachers who play that podcast in their classroom for their students because they're short, 3 or 4 minutes long. Kids have short attention spans, and so they're able to learn some neat historical tales in a short amount of time and keep them engaged and entertained. So I also try to maintain a little bit of a filter on things like violence or anxiety, things that might come up and I don't want little kids to experience. So those are my filters. I want it to be delightful and I want it to be a little bit on the safer side. Unlike Lore, you know, my bigger podcast, that one, it gets a bit dangerous. So yeah, that's my filter. As for the book, it was a matter of going through early stories and saying, what are the apparent categories that this fits into? You know, things like Stubby and Oni really call out for there to be an amazing animal section in the book. And so we've gathered a bunch of amazing animal stories from early in the show. Coincidences, as we've discussed, just made sense. There's a lot of those stories on the podcast. Let's get a lot of those into the book. And then, you know, some of the surprising store categories that jumped out at me were things like, I didn't realize how many military stories we'd actually put together, but you know, there they were. Or celebrity stories. I didn't realize we had done that many of them. So yeah, it was a matter of looking at the tales and them sort of calling out for certain categories that they fall into.
This one I was going to do anyway, and it was about, well, I love croissants, and of course, if
Who
you ask
doesn't, right?
right and go up to anybody and ask them where that croissant was invented, and they're going to say, well, of course, it was France. It's croissant,
Right.
and we learn in the book through the story there. Wrong.
Yeah, absolutely wrong. And I don't know if this is your personality type, Paul. I love to break hearts by letting people know that the thing they've always assumed is true is actually wrong. It's just a little quirk of mine. I love to do that, be the bearer of bad news. So croissants are one of those stories. You would think it's French in origin, but it actually goes back to 1683 when the city of Vienna, which is in modern day Austria, was under siege by the Ottoman Empire. And they, unlike a lot of cities who are under siege, they actually managed to repel their attackers and Vienna stood free and safe. And to celebrate their victory, some of the bakers in Vienna said, well, the enemy that has been attacking us all this time has a crescent that's on their flag. The Ottoman Empire, the Turks, they had a crescent on their flag. So why don't we make a pastry in the shape of a crescent? And I think at the time, the German word for it was a kepfel, which thankfully hasn't stuck around too well. But crescent, obviously, works its way into the French language as croissant, and then they've kind of picked it up and carried it as their own thing. But it all started in Austria, which is
Yeah, so
just
that's a
a
good trip.
fun thing to tell people. Yeah,
I was going to say a lot of this stuff is fun at the parties to go up and
yeah.
say, you know what? I see you're serving croissants. Well, that's not a French thing. And also, I know the morning show, and I know we have shared and different viewers, but there you talked about a guy who wanted to be buried in a Pringles can, and in fact was buried in a Pringles can. So that's amazing. I'll let people watch the WGN morning show slot on that. But something I don't think you did talk about in the morning show, but you know I'm going to ask you, which was about the Frankenstein. I shouldn't say, I already said it. What was the story behind Frankenstein's monster? Because the names that one would bring up, it's not Dr. Frankenstein, it's Giovanni, I think I've, again, my handwriting, Aldini,
Aldini, yeah.
and George Fosler, that's where this story, Forster, I mean, that's where this story goes, and we end up with Frankenstein?
Yeah, you know, there's this, it's a category of history that I absolutely love. There was a time in the 1800s where people were just absolutely obsessed with electricity. I mean, today we just plug things in, we just expect everything to work. But back
Ben
then,
Franklin was obsessed with electricity.
yeah, absolutely. There was some of the names you'll Giovanni Aldini was the nephew of a guy named I'm forgetting his name now.
We'll call him Uncle.
He had an uncle that dabbled with electricity, did a lot of great research. He was a physicist and a chemist, and Aldini followed in his footsteps and really started to practice. One of their like fellow scientists, but also kind of a competitor, Volta. Volta was he's the guy that's responsible for what we would think of as the battery. The voltaic pile is what they called it. And so Aldini would travel Europe with a voltaic pile that had cables that came out of it and a metal rod, and he would electrocute corpses of animals, frogs, dogs, things that didn't rhyme with frogs and dogs. And at some point in early 1800s, I want to say it was 1803 or so, he ends up in London at the execution of a criminal named George Forster. And this is his big moment. He's going to experiment on a human cadaver. And so they take the body down from the gallows and immediately rush it off to a medical theater, which, back then, a medical theater really was a lot like a theater. It was stadium seating, all looking down on a table, and they packed the room with
Great
students.
fun.
Great fun for the whole family. And for like 6 hours until that battery went dead, he stood there and walked around the corpse and shocked George Forster's body with this thing to show, look, if I shock him on the side of the head, what body part moves in response? What happens when I do this? What happens when I do this? And did this for hours and hours. So the public was enamored with electrical experiments like this. I mean, there were poets who were writing poetry about electricity. Charles Darwin's father, Erasmus Darwin, was a poet and a scientist, and he wrote poetry about electricity and its ability to bring life back to the dead. And so this topic floated around in poetic circles for a long time. Enter the family of William Godwin. He was a writer. He had a lot of writers around him, a lot of poets in the family. And he and his wife Mary had some kids. One of their daughters was also named Mary. And Mary Godwin, at some point, goes off to have a little vacation with some friends on Lake Geneva. And it's known as the summer, the year without a summer, because of a volcanic eruption halfway around the world, we lost basically all the heat of the summer, and they had a horrible time. So they stayed inside, and they had to come up with something to do, sitting around a fire. And they said, "Let's have a contest to see who can write the scariest story." And young Mary Godwin goes off, and she writes her story, and that story ends up becoming Frankenstein. Mary, of course, goes on to become Mary Shelley.
Right.
Mary's a poet named Percy Bysshe Shelley, and that realm of poetry, electricity, all of it sort of comes together in that moment for Mary, and she writes what is the birth of the science fiction genre and one of the most legendary stories of all time. So
Oh, David.
I love that it begins with a guy shocking a corpse on a table in front of medical students. So,
Yeah, and
yeah.
she picks up on that. I want to ask you a story about, I love talking about, we've got a primarily, I'm guessing, I don't know, maybe I'm wrong, Chicago audience and Illinois audience. So I'm going to have an Illinois story. I'm going to ask you about Abraham Lincoln. So I'll see whether you remember the end of this from this story. I think it's one of the, I love this from the book. But there was a story about Abraham Lincoln, and it's fascinating. I didn't know this either, as much as I love Lincoln and have some Lincoln memorabilia. But Abraham Lincoln's son, it turns out, was rescued by John Wilkes Booth's brother. Now, there's a tie
Yeah.
one would not ever think of making, but can you briefly tell us that Illinois, it's Illinois based because Lincoln is from Illinois, but Illinois based story?
It's one of those coincidence stories that I absolutely love. I really do. Lincoln had a son named Robert Todd Lincoln, and he was on a train station platform in, I believe, New Jersey. I want to say it was Jersey City, New Jersey. In 1864, and it was a busy train platform, and people were jostling, probably just like today, where there's a lot of people who want to get on before the people on the train get off and all that. And somebody bumped Robert Todd Lincoln, and he was going to fall down beneath the wheels of the train and die. And a hand reached out of the audience, of the crowd, and pulled him back and saved his life. And when he turned to look at the man who saved him, he recognized him because the man was a famous actor. He came from a family of famous actors. His dad was an actor, his brother was an actor, and there weren't a lot of famous actors in the 1860s. So he knew his face, and he thanked him. The man made sure that Robert Todd Lincoln was safe and all that. Well, the man who saved him was Edwin Thomas Booth, and the Booth name will infamously be connected to the assassination of Lincoln
Right.
because Edwin Thomas Booth, John Wilkes Booth, are brothers. And so you have this weird situation, a coincidence, where Lincoln's son is saved by one Booth, and yet the other Booth takes Abraham Lincoln's life just a year later. And it's one of those magical coincidences that's a little bittersweet, but It's also very entertaining.
That's what this book is filled with. If we haven't enticed people by now, I don't know how to help. But the book is called Cabinet of Curiosities by Aaron Mankey, Mahnke. Find it on Amazon, any place you want them to go, because you have a website where a lot of this stuff is available.
I mean, wherever it's convenient for them to buy the book, it's in audiobook format, which is, obviously narrated by me. We've got some great interviews between the categories. It's an ebook and obviously in hardcover. I'm partial to the hardcover though, because it's a gorgeous book. So
It's what I've got. It's
that's
fantastic.
right.
Aaron, congratulations. Cabinet of Curiosity is a fantastic book. Thanks for your time. I
Thanks,
appreciate
Paul.
it. Great stories. We'll talk again. Thanks.
Thanks so much. Cheers.